Chapter 38. Rastenburg, Germany. Kurt Vogel was fussing with his collar. He was wearing his Kriegsmarine uniform for the first time in longer than he could remember. It fit before the war, but Vogel, like almost everyone else, had lost weight. Now his tunic hung on him like prison pajamas. He was nervous as hell. He had never met the Führer. In fact, he had never been in the same room with the man. Personally, he thought Hitler was a lunatic and a monster who had led Germany to the brink of catastrophe. But he found he was eager to meet him, and, for some inexplicable reason, he wanted to make a good impression. He wished he had a better speaking voice. He chain-smoked to ease his nerves. He had smoked the entire flight from Berlin, and now he was smoking again in the car. Canaris finally pleaded with him to put the damned thing out for the sake of the Dachshunds. They were lying at Vogel's feet like fat sausages, glaring up at him malevolently. Vogel cracked the window and tossed his cigarette into the swirling snow. The staff Mercedes stopped at the outer checkpoint of Hitler's Wolfschanze. Four SS guards descended on the car, threw open the hood in the trunk, and used mirrors to search the undercarriage. The SS men waved them forward, and they drove a half mile toward the compound. It was late afternoon, but the forest floor burned with brilliant white arc light. Guards with Alsatians patrolled the footpaths. The car stopped again in the compound, and again they were set upon by SS men. This time the inspection was personal. They were ordered out of the car and body searched. Vogel was shocked at the sight of Wilhelm Canaris, the chief of Germany's intelligence service, standing with his arms in the air, an SS man patting him down as if he were a beer hall drunk. A guard demanded Vogel's briefcase, and he reluctantly handed it over. It contained the photographs of the Allied documents and the hastily produced analysis from the Abwehr technical staff in Berlin. The SS man dug inside the briefcase with a gloved hand, and then returned it to Vogel, satisfied it contained no weapons or explosives. Vogel joined Canaris, and they walked wordlessly toward the stairs that descended into the bunker. Two of the photographs Vogel had left behind in Berlin, locked in his file cabinets. The photographs of the note. The hand was hers. Vogel recognized the jagged scar at the base of her thumb. He was torn. Accede to her wishes and extract her from Britain or leave her in place. He suspected the decision would be made for him. Another SS man waited at the top of the stairs, just in case the Führer's visitors were somehow able to arm themselves during the walk across the compound. Canaris and Vogel stopped and submitted to yet another search. Canaris looked at Vogel and said, "Welcome to Camp Paranoia." Vogel and Canaris were the first to arrive. "Smoke now before the chicken farmer gets here," Canaris said. Vogel cringed at the remark. Surely the room was thoroughly bugged. Leafing through his files, he fought off the craving for tobacco. Vogel watched as the most powerful men of the Third Reich filed into the room one by one. Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler, Brigadeführer Walter Schellenberg, Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt, Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, and Hermann Göring. They all rose when Hitler entered the room, 20 minutes behind schedule. He wore slate-gray trousers and a black tunic. He remained standing after everyone else sat. Vogel watched him, fascinated. The hair was graying, the skin sallow, the eyes red-rimmed. The dark circles beneath them were so pronounced they looked like bruises. Yet there was a daunting energy about him. For 2 hours he dominated the other men in the room as he led the conference on preparations for the invasion, probing, challenging, dismissing information or insight deemed irrelevant. It was clear to Vogel that Adolf Hitler knew as much, if not more, about the disposition of his forces in the West than his senior military officers. His attention to detail was astonishing. He demanded to know why there were 3 fewer anti-aircraft guns in the Pas-de-Calais than in the previous week. He wanted to know the exact kind of concrete used for the Atlantic Wall fortifications and the precise thickness at which it was laid. Finally, at the end of the conference, he turned to Canaris and said, "So, I'm told the Abwehr has uncovered another piece of information that might shed some light on the enemy's intentions."
"Actually, my Führer,
The operation was conceived and executed by Captain Fogel. I'll allow him to brief you on his findings.
Fine, Hitler said. Captain Fogel?
Fogel remained seated.
My Führer, 2 days ago in London, one of our agents took possession of a document. As you know, we have discovered the enemies engaged in something called Operation Mulberry. Based on these new documents, we are now closer to learning exactly what Mulberry is.
Closer?
Hitler said, his head tilting back.
So you are still engaging in guesswork, Captain?
If I may continue, my Führer.
Please, but I have limited patience this evening.
We now know much more about the giant concrete and steel structures being built at several points around England. We now know they are codenamed Phoenix. We also know that when the invasion comes, they will be towed across the English Channel and sunk off the coast of France.
Sunk? For what possible purpose, Captain Fogel?
For the past 24 hours, our technical analysts have been poring over the documents stolen in London. Each of the submersible units contains quarters for a crew and a large anti-aircraft gun. It is possible the enemy is planning to create a huge coastal anti-aircraft complex to provide additional cover for their troops during the invasion.
Possible, Hitler said. But why go to so much trouble to construct an anti-aircraft facility? All your estimates indicate the British are desperately short of raw materials. Steel, concrete, aluminum. You've been telling me that for months. Churchill has bankrupted Britain with this foolish war. Why waste precious supplies on such a project?
Hitler turned and glared at Göring.
Besides, I'm afraid we must assume that the enemy will enjoy supremacy in the air during the invasion.
Hitler turned back toward Fogel.
Do you have a second theory, Captain Fogel?
We do, my Führer. It is a minority opinion, very preliminary and still open to a great deal of interpretation.
Let's hear it, he snapped.
One of our analysts believes the submersible units might actually be components of some sort of artificial harbour, a device that could be constructed in Britain, towed across the Channel and installed along the French coast during the first hours of the invasion.
Hitler, intrigued, was pacing again.
An artificial harbour? Is such a thing possible?
Himmler cleared his throat gently. Perhaps your analysts are misreading the information provided by the agent, Captain Fogel. An artificial harbour sounds a little far-fetched to me.
No, Herr Reichsführer,
Hitler said.
I think Captain Fogel may be onto something here.
Hitler paced the room violently.
An artificial harbour! Imagine the arrogance, the audacity of such a project! I see the fingerprints of that madman Churchill all over this!
My Führer, Fogel said hesitantly, an artificial harbour is only one possible explanation for these concrete units. I would caution against putting too much emphasis on these early findings.
No, Captain Fogel. I'm intrigued by this theory of yours. Let's take it to the next level, just for argument's sake. If the enemy is actually engaged in an attempt to build something as elaborate as an artificial harbour, where would he put it? Von Rundstedt, you first.
The old field marshal rose, walked to the map, and tapped at it with his baton.
If one studies the failed enemy assault on Dieppe in 1942, one can learn valuable lessons. The enemy's primary objective was to seize and open a major port as quickly as possible. The enemy failed, of course. The problem is this. The enemy knows we will deny him the use of ports for as long as possible, and that we will cripple those ports before surrendering them. I suppose it is possible the enemy might be constructing facilities in Britain that would allow him to reopen the ports more quickly. That makes sense to me. If that is the case, and I stress that Captain Fogel and his colleagues have no conclusive proof it is so, I still believe it is Calais. An invasion at Calais still makes the most sense militarily and strategically. This cannot be ignored.
Hitler listened carefully, then turned to Fogel.
What do you think of the field marshal's analysis, Captain Fogel?
Fogel looked up. Von Rundstedt's icy gaze had settled on him. He knew he had to proceed very carefully.
Field Marshal von Rundstedt's argument is extremely sound.
Fogel paused as von Rundstedt nodded in acknowledgement.
But for the sake of discussion, may I offer a second interpretation?
Do so, Hitler said.
As the Field Marshal has pointed out, the enemy desperately needs port facilities if he is to build up supplies quickly enough to sustain an invasion force. We estimate that would require at least 10,000 tons of supplies each day during the first phase of the operation. Any of the ports on the Pas-de-Calais could sustain such a massive build-up. Calais, Boulogne, Dunkirk, for example. But as Field Marshal von Rundstedt pointed out, the enemy knows we will demolish those ports before surrendering them. The enemy also knows those ports will be heavily defended. A frontal assault on any one of them would be very costly.
Fogel could see that Hitler was fidgeting, growing impatient. He hurried things along.
Along the Normandy coast there are a number of small fishing ports, none of them large enough to handle the necessary build-up of material and heavy equipment. Even Cherbourg might not be large enough. Remember, it was designed as a passenger terminal for transatlantic liners, not for discharging cargo.
Your point, Captain Fogel,
Hitler said, an edge to his voice.
My Führer, what if it were possible for the enemy to build up his supplies and equipment on open beaches rather than through a port? If that were indeed possible, the enemy could avoid our strongest defenses, land on the less heavily defended beaches of Normandy, and attempt to supply an invasion force through the use of an artificial harbor.
Hitler's eyes flickered. He was clearly intrigued by Fogel's analysis. Field Marshal Erwin Rommel was shaking his head.
A scenario such as yours would be a recipe for disaster, Captain Fogel. Even in spring, the weather along the Channel coast can be extremely hazardous. Rain, high winds, heavy seas. My staff has studied the patterns. If history is a guide, the enemy can expect periods of good weather for no more than 3 or 4 days at a time. If he attempts to build up his forces on an open beach, with no harbor and no sheltered water, the enemy will be totally at the mercy of nature. And no portable device, no matter how ingenious, will survive a springtime gale on the English Channel.
Hitler stepped in.
A fascinating discussion, gentlemen, but enough. Obviously, Captain Fogel, your agent needs to discover more about the project. I assume the agent is still in place?
Fogel proceeded carefully.
There is a problem, my Führer,
Fogel said.
The agent feels the British security forces may be closing in, that it may not be safe to remain in England much longer.
Walter Schellenberg spoke for the first time.
Captain Fogel, our own source in London says quite the opposite, that the British know there is a leak, but have been unable to plug it. Your agent is imagining the danger at this time.
Fogel thought, arrogant ass, who's this great source the SD has in London? He said,
the agent in question is highly trained and exceptionally intelligent. I think...
Himmler cut Fogel off.
Surely you don't assume Brigadefuhrer Schellenberg's source is less credible than your own, Captain Fogel?
With respect, I have no way to judge the credibility of the Brigadefuhrer's source, Herr Reichsführer.
A very diplomatic answer, Herr Captain, Himmler said. But clearly your agent should remain in place until we know the truth about these concrete objects, wouldn't you agree?
Fogel was trapped. To disagree with Himmler would be like signing his own death warrant. They could manufacture evidence of treason against him and hang him with piano wire like they did the others. He thought of Gertrude and the children. The barbarians would go after them, too. He trusted Anna's instincts, but to pull her out now would be suicide. He had no choice. She would remain in place.
Yes, I agree, Herr Reichsführer.
Himmler invited Fogel for a walk around the grounds. Night had fallen. Beyond the sphere of arc light, the forest was very dark. A sign warned not to stray from the footpath because of mines. Wind stirred the tops of the conifers. Fogel could hear a dog barking. It was difficult to tell how far away, because the new snow reduced all sound to a dull muffle. It was bitter cold. During the tense meeting, he had perspired heavily beneath his tunic. Now, in the cold, it felt as if his clothes had frozen to his body. He craved a cigarette, but decided not to risk offending Himmler further for one day. Himmler's voice, when he finally spoke, was nearly inaudible. Fogel wondered if it was possible to bug a forest.
A remarkable achievement, Captain Fogel.
You are to be commended.
I'm honored, Herr Reichsführer.
Your agent in London is a woman. Fogel said nothing.
It was always my impression that Admiral Canaris distrusted female agents, that he believed they are too susceptible to emotion for clandestine work and lack the necessary objectivity.
I can assure you, Herr Reichsführer, that the agent involved has none of those shortcomings.
I must admit, I find the practice of inserting female agents behind enemy lines a bit distasteful myself. The SOE persists in sending women into France. When they are arrested, I'm afraid the women suffer the same fate as the men. To inflict such suffering on a woman is regrettable, to say the least. He paused, cheek muscle twitching, and breathed deeply of the cold night air. Your achievement is even more remarkable because you succeeded in spite of Admiral Canaris.
I'm not sure what you mean, Herr Reichsführer.
What I mean is that the Admiral's days at the Abwehr are numbered. We have been unhappy with his performance for some time. He is at least an incompetent, and if my suspicions are correct, he's a traitor to the Führer as well.
Herr Reichsführer, I've never...
Himmler cut him off with a wave of his hand. I know you feel a certain loyalty to Admiral Canaris. After all, he is personally responsible for your rapid rise through the ranks of the Abwehr. But nothing you can say now can possibly change my opinion of Canaris. And a word to the wise, be careful when coming to the aid of a drowning man. You may be dragged under as well. Fogel was stunned. He said nothing. The barking of the dog faded slowly away, then was gone. The wind rose and blew snow across the path, erasing the border with the forest. Fogel wondered how close they laid the mines. He turned his head and glimpsed a pair of SS men trailing softly after them.
It is now February, Himmler resumed. I can predict with some certainty that Admiral Canaris will be dismissed soon. Perhaps even by the end of the month.
I intend to bring all the security and intelligence agencies of Germany under my control, including the Abwehr. Fogel thought, the Abwehr under Himmler's control? It would be laughable if he wasn't serious.
You are obviously a man of considerable talent, Himmler continued. I want you to remain at the Abwehr, with a considerable promotion, of course.
Thank you, Herr Reichsführer.
It was as if someone else said the words for him. Himmler stopped. It's cold. We should start back. They walked past the security men, who waited until Himmler and Fogel were out of earshot before falling in quietly behind them. Himmler said, I'm glad we were able to reach agreement on the matter of leaving the agent in place. I think it is the prudent course of action at this time. And besides, Herr Fogel, it is never wise for one's personal feelings to cloud one's judgment. Fogel stopped walking and looked into Himmler's desolate eyes.
What do you mean by that?
Please don't treat me like a fool, Himmler said. Brigadeführer Schellenberg spent some time in Madrid on another matter this past week. He met a friend of yours there, a man named Emilio Romero. Senor Romero told Brigadefuhrer Schellenberg all about your most prized possession.
Fogel thought, damn Emilio for talking to Schellenberg, damn Himmler for sticking his nose into places it doesn't belong. The SS men seemed to sense tension, and they drifted silently forward.
I understand she's very beautiful, Himmler said. It must have been difficult to give up a woman like that. It must be tempting to bring her home and lock her away. But she is to remain in place in England. Is that clear, Captain Fogel?
Yes, Herr Reichsführer.
Schellenberg has his faults. Arrogant, too flashy, and this obsession with pornography. Himmler shrugged. But he's a clever and resourceful intelligence officer. I know you're going to enjoy working more closely with him. Himmler turned abruptly and walked away. Fogel stood alone, shivering in the intense cold.
You don't look well,
Canaris said when Fogel returned to the car.
I usually feel that way after conversations with the chicken farmer, but I must admit I do a better job of hiding it than you.
There was a scratching at the side of the car. Canaris opened his door and the dogs scampered inside and settled at Fogel's feet. Canaris rapped his knuckle on the glass divider. The engine turned over and the car crunched over the snow toward the gate. Fogel felt relief wash over him as the glare of the compound receded behind them, and they returned once more to the gloom of the forest.
The little corporal was very proud of you tonight, Canaris said, contempt in his voice.
And what about Himmler? Did you stick the dagger in me during your little moonlight stroll?
Herr Admiral!
Canaris leaned over and put his hand on Fogel's arm. There was a look in his ice-blue eyes Fogel had never seen.
Be careful, Kurt, he said. It is a dangerous game you are playing. A very dangerous game.
And with that, Canaris leaned back, closed his eyes, and was immediately asleep. Chapter 39. London. The operation was hastily codenamed Kettledrum. Who chose the name and why, Vickery did not know. It was too complex and too sensitive to be run from his cramped quarters in St. James's Street, so for his command post, Vickery procured a stately Georgian house in a terrace in West Halkin Street. The drawing room was converted into a situation room, with extra telephones, a wireless set, and a large-scale map of metropolitan London tacked to the wall. The upstairs library was turned into an office for Vickery and Harry. There was a rear entrance for the watchers and a pantry stocked with food. The typists volunteered to do the cooking, and Vickery, arriving at the house early that evening, was struck by the aroma of toast and bacon and the lamb stew bubbling on the stove. A watcher led him upstairs to the library. A coal fire burned in the fireplace. The air was dry and warm. He struggled out of his sodden Macintosh, hung it on a hanger, and hung the hanger on the back of the door. One of the girls had left him a pot of tea, and he poured himself a cup. Vickery was exhausted. He had slept poorly after interrogating Jordan, and his hope of catching a little sleep in the car had been dashed by Boothby, who suggested they ride back to the office together so they could use the time to talk. Overall control of Kettledrum was Boothby's. Vickery would run Jordan and be responsible for keeping Catherine Blake under surveillance. At the same time, he would try to discover the rest of the agents in the network and their means of communication with Berlin. Boothby would be the liaison to the 20 Committee, the interdepartmental group that supervised the entire double-cross apparatus, so named because the symbol of double-cross and the Roman numeral for 20 are the same, XX. Boothby and the 20 Committee would produce the misleading documents for Jordan's briefcase and integrate Kettledrum into the rest of double-cross and bodyguard. Vickery did not ask about the nature of the misinformation, and Boothby did not tell him. Vickery knew what it meant. He had discovered the existence of the new German network and traced the leak back to Jordan. But now he was being shoved into a supporting role. Basil Boothby was fully in command.
Nice digs, Harry said as he entered the room. He poured himself a cup of tea and warmed his backside against the fire. Where's Jordan?
Upstairs, sleeping.
Dumb bastard,
Harry said, his voice lowered.
He's our dumb bastard now, Harry. Don't forget that. What have you got?
Fingerprints.
What?
Fingerprints. Latent fingerprints from someone other than Peter Jordan. All over the inside of that study. On the desk, on the exterior of the safe.
He says the cleaning lady was never allowed to go in. We should assume those latent fingerprints were left by Catherine Blake. Vickery shook his head slowly.
Jordan's house is ready to go, Harry continued. We put so many microphones in that place you can hear a mouse fart. We evicted the family across the street and established a static post. The view is perfect. Anyone goes near that house gets their picture taken.
What about Catherine Blake?
We traced her telephone number to a flat in Earl's Court. We took over a flat in the building opposite.
Good work, Harry. Harry looked at Vickery a long moment, then said,
Don't take this the wrong way, Alfred, but you look like hell.
I can't remember the last time I slept. What's keeping you going?
A couple of Benzedrine and 10 quarts of tea.
I'm going to have a bite to eat, then try to get some sleep. What about you?
Actually, I had plans for the evening.
Grace Clarendon?
She asked me to dinner. I thought I'd take the opportunity. I don't think we're going to have much free time the next few weeks.
Vickery rose and poured himself another cup of tea. Harry, I don't want to take advantage of your relationship with Grace, but I'm wondering if she could do me a favor. I'd like her to run a couple of names quietly through registry and see what comes up.
I'll ask her. What are the names?
Vickery carried his tea across the room and stood in front of the fire next to Harry. Peter Jordan, Walker Hardigan, and anyone or anything called Broom. Grace never liked to eat before making love. Afterward, Harry lay in her bed, smoking a cigarette, listening to Glenn Miller on the gramophone and the clatter of Grace cooking in her tiny kitchen. She came back into the bedroom 10 minutes later. She wore a robe loosely tied at her slender waist and carried a tray with their supper on it, soup and bread. Harry sat up against the headboard and Grace leaned against the footboard. The tray was between them. She handed him a bowl of the soup. It was nearly midnight, and they both were starved. Harry loved to watch her, the way she seemed to take such pleasure from the simple meal, the way her robe parted to reveal her taut, perfect body. She noticed him looking at her and said,
What are you thinking, Harry Dalton?
I was thinking how much I never want this to end. I was thinking how much I wish every night of my life could be just like this.
Her face became very grave. She was absolutely incapable of hiding her emotions. When she was happy, her face seemed to light up. When she was angry, her green eyes smoldered. And when she was sad, like now, her body became very still.
You mustn't say things like that, Harry. It's against the rules.
I know it's against the rules, but it's the truth.
Sometimes it's better to keep the truth to yourself. If you don't say it out loud, it doesn't hurt so much.
Grace, I think I'm in love.
She slammed down her spoon on the tray.
Jesus, Harry, don't say things like that. You make it so damned hard sometimes. First you say you can't see me because you're feeling guilty, and now you're telling me you're in love with me.
I'm sorry, Grace. It's just the truth. I thought we could always tell each other the truth.
All right. Here's the truth. I'm married to a wonderful man I care for very much and don't want to hurt. But I've fallen desperately in love with a detective-turned-spycatcher named Harry Dalton. And when this damned war is over, I have to give him up. And it hurts like bloody hell every time I let myself think about it.
Her eyes welled with tears.
Now shut up and eat your soup. Please. Let's talk about something else. I'm stuck in dreary registry all day with Jago and his wretched pipe. I want to know what's going on in the rest of the world.
All right. I have a favor to ask of you.
What kind of favor?
A professional favor.
She smiled at him wickedly.
Damn, I was hoping it was a sexual favor.
I need you to quietly run a couple of names through the registry index. See if anything comes up.
Sure, what are they?
Harry told her.
Okay, I'll see what I can find.
She finished the soup, leaned back, and watched Harry while he ate the rest of his soup. When he was done, she stacked the dishes on the tray and set the tray on the floor next to the bed. She turned out the lights and lit a candle on the bedstand. She took off her robe and she made love to him in a way she never had before, slowly, patiently,
as if his body were made of crystal. Her eyes never strayed from his face. When it was over, she fell forward onto his chest, her body limp and damp, her warm breath against his neck.
"You wanted the truth, Harry? That's the truth."
"I have to be honest with you, Grace. It didn't hurt."
It began a few minutes past 10 o'clock the following morning when Peter Jordan, standing in the upstairs library of Vicary's house in West Halkin Street, dialed the number for Catherine Blake's flat. For a long time, the recording of this one-minute conversation held the distinction of the most listened-to wiretap in the history of the Imperial Security Service. Vicary himself would listen to the damned thing 100 times, searching for imperfections like a master jeweler examining a diamond for flaws. Boothby did the same. A copy of the recording was rushed back to St. James's Street by motorcycle courier, and for 1 hour the red light burned over Sir Basil's door as he listened over and over again. The first time Vicary heard only Jordan. He was standing a few feet away, his back politely turned, his eyes fixed on the fire.
"Listen, I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to call sooner. I've just been busy as hell. I was out of town a day longer than I expected, and there was no way for me to call."
Silence, while she tells him there's no need to apologize.
"I missed you very much. I thought about you the entire time I was away."
Silence, while she tells him she missed him terribly and can't wait to see him again.
"I want to see you, too. In fact, that's why I'm calling. I booked us a table at the Mirabel. I hope you're free for lunch."
Silence, while she tells him that sounds wonderful.
"Good. I'll meet you there at 1 o'clock.
Silence, while she says she loves him very much.
"I love you too, darling."
Jordan was quiet when it was over. Vicary, watching him, was reminded of Carl Becker and the dark mood he slipped into whenever Vicary forced him to send a double-cross message. They killed the rest of the morning with chess. Jordan played a precise mathematical match. Vicary engaged in deception and subterfuge. While they played, they could hear the banter of the watchers and the clatter of the typists downstairs in the Situation Room. Jordan was beating Vicary badly, so Vicary resigned. At noon, Jordan went to his room and dressed in his uniform. At 12:15, he walked out the rear door of the house and clambered into the back of a department van. Vicary and Harry settled into their places downstairs in the Situation Room, while Jordan was driven at speed up Park Lane like a high-security prisoner. He was taken to a secluded rear door of Shafe headquarters in Blackburn Street and went inside. For the next 6 minutes, no one from Vickery's team saw him. Jordan emerged from the front entrance of Shafe at 12:35. He walked across the square, a briefcase chained to his wrist, and vanished into another doorway. This time his absence was 10 minutes. When he reappeared, the briefcase was gone. From Grosvenor Square, he walked to South Audley Street, and from South Audley Street to Curzon Street. During his journey, he was quietly shadowed by 3 of the department's best watchers, Clive Roach, Tony Blair, and Leonard Reeves. None of them saw any signs that Jordan was under surveillance by the opposition. At 12:55, Jordan arrived at the Mirabel. He waited outside, just as Vicary had instructed him to do. At precisely 1 o'clock, a taxi braked to a halt in front of the restaurant, and a tall, attractive woman stepped into view. Ginger Bradshaw, the department's best surveillance photographer, was crouched in the back of a department van parked across the street. As Catherine Blake took Peter Jordan's hand and kissed his cheek, he quickly shot 6 photographs. The film was rushed back to West Halkin Street, and the prints were sitting in front of Vicary in the Situation Room by the time they had finished lunch. When it was over, Blair would say it was his fault. Reeves said no, it was his. Roach, being the senior man, took responsibility himself. All 3 agreed she was a cut above every other German agent they had ever followed, the best, bar none. And if they ever made a mistake, got too close, fingers would surely be burned. After leaving the Mirabel, Catherine and Peter walked together back to Grosvenor Square. They stopped on the southwest corner of the square and talked for 2 minutes. Ginger Bradshaw took several more photographs, including one of their very brief kiss goodbye. When Jordan walked away,
Catherine flagged down a taxi and climbed inside. Blair, Roach, and Reeves jumped into the surveillance van and followed the taxi east to Regent Street. The taxi then headed north to Oxford Street, where Catherine paid off the cabbie and climbed out. Later, Roach would call her stroll along Oxford Street the best demonstration of street craft he had ever seen. She paused in at least a half dozen storefronts. She doubled back twice, once so quickly that Blair had to dive into a cafe to get out of the way. At Tottenham Court Road, she descended into the underground and purchased a ticket for Waterloo. Roach and Reeves both managed to get on the train with her. Roach, 20 feet away in the same car, Reeves in the next one. When the doors opened at Leicester Square, she remained still, as if she were going to continue on. Then suddenly she stood up and stepped onto the platform. Roach had to squeeze through the closing doors to stay with her. Reeves was stuck on the train. He was out of the game. She melted into the crowd on the staircase, and Roach lost her momentarily. When she reached street level, she quickly crossed Charing Cross Road and took the stairs back into the Leicester Square station. Roach could have sworn he saw her climb onto a waiting bus, and for the rest of the afternoon he berated himself for making such a stupid mistake. He rushed across the street and jumped onto the bus as it pulled away from the curb. 10 seconds later, he realized he had the wrong woman. He got off the bus at the next stop and telephoned Vickery at West Hulkin Street to tell him she had given them the slip.
"Clive Roach has never lost a German agent before," Boothby said, glaring at the watch report that evening in his office. He looked up at Vickery. "The man could follow a gnat through Hampstead Heath."
"He's the best. She's just damned good."
"Look at this. A taxi, a long walk to check her tail, then into the underground, where she buys a ticket for one station and gets out at another."
"She's extremely careful. That's why we've never caught on to her."
"There's another explanation, Alfred. It's possible she spotted the tail."
"I know. I've thought about that possibility."
"And if that's the case, the entire operation is blown even before it started."
Boothby tapped the thin metal attaché case containing the first batch of kettle drum material.
"If she knows she's under surveillance, and we give her this, we might as well publish the secret of the invasion in the Daily Mail under a bloody banner headline. They'll know they're being deceived. And if they know they're being deceived, they'll know the opposite is true."
"Roach is convinced she didn't spot him."
"Where is she now?"
"She's in her flat."
"What time is she supposed to meet Jordan?"
10 o'clock, at Jordan's house. He told her he was working late tonight."
"What were Jordan's impressions?"
"He said he detected no change in her demeanor, no sign of nerves or tension."
Vickery paused.
"He's good, our Commander Jordan. Damned good. If he weren't such an excellent engineer, he'd make a marvelous spy."
Boothby tapped the metal attaché case with his thick forefinger.
"If she spotted the tail, why is she sitting in her flat? Why isn't she making a run for it?"
Vickery said, "Perhaps she wants to see what's inside that briefcase."
"It's not too late, Alfred. We don't have to go through with this. We can arrest her right now and think of some other way to repair the damage."
"I think that would be a mistake. We don't know the other agents in the network, and we don't know how they're communicating with Berlin."
Boothby rapped his knuckle against the attaché case.
"You haven't asked what's inside this briefcase, Alfred."
"I didn't want another lecture about need to know."
Boothby chuckled and said,
"Very good. You're learning. You don't need to know this, but since it's your brilliant idea, I'm going to tell you. The 20 Committee wants to convince them that Mulberry is actually an offshore anti-aircraft complex bound for Calais. The Phoenix units already have crew quarters and anti-aircraft guns, so it's a rather neat fit. They've just altered the drawings a bit."
"Perfect," Vickery said.
"They have some other schemes in mind to help sell the deception through other channels. You'll be briefed on those as necessary."
"I understand, Sir Basil."
They sat in silence for a time, each studying his own private spot on the panelled walls.
"It's your call, Alfred," Boothby said. "You control this part of the operation. Whatever you recommend, I'll back you up on it."
Vickery thought, "Why do I feel as though I'm being measured for the drop?" He did not take comfort from Boothby's offer of support. The first sign of trouble and Boothby would be diving for the nearest foxhole. The easiest thing to do would be to arrest Catherine Blake and do it Boothby's way, try to turn her and force her to cooperate with them. Vickery remained convinced it would not work, that the only way to funnel the double-cross material directly through her was to do it without her knowledge.
"I remember a time when men didn't have to make decisions like this," Boothby said wistfully. "If we make the wrong one, we could very well lose the war."
"Thank you for reminding me," Vickery said. "You don't have a crystal ball behind that desk, do you, Sir Basil?"
"I'm afraid not."
"How about a coin?"
"Alfred!"
"A poor attempt at levity, Sir Basil." Boothby was tapping on the attaché again.
"What's your decision, Alfred?"
"I say we let her run," Boothby said.
"I hope to God you're right. Give me your right arm."
Vickery stuck out his arm. Boothby shackled the attaché case to his wrist. Half an hour later, Grace Clarendon was standing in Northumberland Avenue, stomping her feet against the pavement for warmth, as she watched the evening traffic rushing past. Finally, she spotted Boothby's large black Humber when the driver winked the shaded headlamps. The car pulled over. Boothby threw open the back door and Grace climbed inside. Grace shivered. "Bloody cold outside. You were supposed to meet me 15 minutes ago. I don't know why we can't just do this in your office."
"Too many watchful eyes, Grace. Too much at stake."
She stuck a cigarette into her mouth and lit it. Boothby closed the glass partition.
"Now, what do you have for me?"
"Vickery wants me to run a couple of names through registry for him."
"Why doesn't he come to me for a chit?"
"I suppose he thinks he won't give it to him."
"What are the names?"
"Peter Jordan and Walker Hardigan."
"Clever bastard,"
Boothby murmured.
"Anything else?"
"Yes. He wanted me to run a trace on the word broom."
"How broad?"
"Names of our own personnel. Code names of agents, German and British. Operational code names, existing or closed."
"For Christ's sake,"
Boothby said. He turned and watched the traffic.
"Did Vickery come to you directly, or did he make the request through Dalton?"
"Harry did it."
"When?"
"Last night." Boothby turned and smiled at her.
"Grace, have you been a naughty girl again?"
She didn't respond, just said, "What do you want me to tell him?"
"Tell him you searched for the names of Jordan and Hardigan in every index you could think of and found nothing. The same for Broom." "Understood, Grace?"
She nodded.
Boothby said, "Don't look so glum. You're making an invaluable contribution to your nation's defense."
She turned at him, narrowed her green eyes in anger.
"I'm deceiving someone I care about very much, and I don't like it."
"It will all be over soon. When it is, I'll treat you to a nice dinner out, just like the old days."
She pulled the door latch, a little too forcefully, and put a foot out the door.
"I'll let you take me to an expensive dinner, Basil, but that's all. The old days are definitely over."
She got out, slammed the door, and watched Boothby's car vanish into the dark. Vickery waited upstairs in the library. The girls brought in the updates, one by one. 21:15 hours. The static post at Earl's Court spots Catherine Blake leaving her flat. Photographs to follow. 21:17 hours. Catherine Blake walks north towards Cromwell Road. One watcher trailing on foot. Surveillance van following. 21:20 hours. Catherine Blake catches a taxi and heads east. Surveillance van collects watcher on foot and tails the taxi. 21:35 hours. Catherine Blake arrives Marble Arch and leaves taxi. New watcher leaves the surveillance van and follows on foot. 21:40 hours. Catherine Blake catches another taxi in Oxford Street. Surveillance van nearly loses her, unable to pick up watcher on foot. 21:50 hours. Catherine Blake leaves taxi at Piccadilly Circus, walking west on Piccadilly. New watcher trailing on foot. Surveillance van following. 21:53 hours. Catherine Blake catches bus. Surveillance van following. 21:57 hours. Catherine Blake leaves bus, enters Green Park on footpath, one watcher following. 5 minutes later, Harry came into the room.
"We lost her in Green Park," he said. "She doubled back. The watcher had to keep going."
"That's all right, Harry. We know where she's going." But for the next 20 minutes, no one saw her. Vickery came downstairs and nervously paced the Situation Room. Through the microphones, Vickery could hear Jordan prowling the inside of his house, waiting for her. Had she seen the watchers? Did she spot the surveillance van? Had she been attacked in Green Park? Was she meeting with another agent? Was she trying to escape? Outside, Vickery heard the rattle of the surveillance van returning, then the soft footfalls of the dejected watchers slipping back into the house. She had beaten them again. Then Boothby telephoned. He was monitoring the operation from his office and wanted to know what the hell was going on. When Vickery told him, Boothby muttered something unintelligible and rang off. Finally, the static post outside Jordan's house came on the air. 22:25 hours. Catherine Blake approaching Jordan's door. Catherine Blake pressing the buzzer. This piece of information Vickery did not need to know, for Jordan's house had been bugged and wired so thoroughly that the door buzzer, over the speakers in the Situation Room, sounded like an air raid alert. Vickery closed his eyes and listened. Their voices rose and fell as they moved from room to room, out of the range of one microphone and into the next. Vickery, listening to them trade banalities, was reminded of the dialogue in one of Alice Simpson's romance novels. "Can I top up your drink?"
"No, it's fine."
"How about something to eat? You must be famished."
"No, I had a little something earlier. But there is something I want desperately right now."
He listened to the sound of their kissing. He searched her voice for false notes. He had a team of officers waiting in the house across the street, just in case it all went wrong and he decided to arrest her. He listened to her telling him how much she loved him, and for some horrid reason he found himself thinking of Helen. They had stopped talking. Clinking glass, running water, footsteps ascending the stairs. Silence as they moved through a dead zone on the microphone coverage. The sound of Jordan's bed creaking beneath the weight of their bodies. The sound of clothing being removed. Whispers. Vickery had heard enough. He turned to Harry and said, "I'm going upstairs. Come get me when she makes her move." Clive Roach heard it first, then Ginger Bradshaw. Harry had fallen asleep on the couch, his long legs dangling over the armrest. Roach reached out and smacked him on the sole of his shoe. Harry, startled, sat up, listening intently. He bounded up the stairs and nearly broke down the door to the library. Vickery had brought his camp bed from his office. He slept, as was his habit, with the light shining on his face. Harry reached down and shook his shoulder. Vickery came awake suddenly and looked at his own wristwatch. 2:45 a.m. He followed Harry wordlessly down the stairs and into the Situation Room. Vickery had experimented with captured German cameras and recognized the sound immediately. Catherine Blake was locked inside Jordan's study, rapidly photographing the first batch of kettle drum material. After a minute, it stopped. Vickery heard the sound of papers being straightened and the door to the safe being closed. Then a click as she turned out the lights and walked back upstairs. Chapter 40. London.
"Well, if it isn't the man of the hour!" Boothby sang, flinging open the rear door of his Humber. "Come inside, Alfred, before you freeze to death out there. I just finished briefing the 20 committee. Needless to say, they're thrilled. They've asked me to pass on their congratulations to you. So, congratulations, Alfred."
"Thank you, I suppose," Vickery said, thinking, when did he have time to brief the 20 committee? It was barely 7 in the morning. Raining, colder than hell, London veiled in the dull half-light of wintry dawn. The car pulled away from the curb into the silent, shimmering street. Vickery slumped down on the seat, leaned his head back and closed his eyes, just for a moment. He was beyond exhaustion. Fatigue pulled at his limbs. It pressed on his chest like the winner of a schoolyard wrestling match, squeezed his head like a vice. He had not slept again,
not after listening to Catherine Blake photographing the kettle drum material. What was it that kept him awake? The excitement of so skillfully deceiving the enemy, or disgust at the manner in which it was done? Vickery opened his eyes. They were heading east, across the Georgian bleakness of Belgravia, then Hyde Park Corner, then Park Lane to Bayswater Road. The streets were deserted, a few taxis here and there, a lorry or two, solitary pedestrians rushing along the pavement like scared survivors of a plague. Vickery, closing his eyes again, said, "What's this all about, anyway?"
"Remember I told you the 20 Committee was considering using some of our other double-cross assets to help bolster the credibility of Kettle Drum in Berlin?"
"I remember," Vickery said. He also remembered he had been stunned by the speed at which the decision had been reached. The 20 Committee was notorious for bureaucratic warfare. Each and every double-cross message had to be approved by the 20 Committee before it could be sent to the Germans through turned agents. Vickery sometimes waited days for the committee to approve double-cross messages for his Becker network. Why were they able to move so quickly now? He was too tired to search his brain for possible answers. He closed his eyes again. "Where are we going?"
"East London. Hoxton, to be precise."
Vickery opened his eyes to a slit, then let them close again.
"If we're going to East London, why are we travelling west along Bayswater Road?" "To make certain we're not being followed by members of any other service, friendly or hostile."
"Who's going to be following us, Sir Basil? The Americans?"
"Actually, Alfred, I'm more worried about the Russians."
Vickery lifted his head and twisted it around at Boothby before letting it fall back onto the leather seat.
"I'd ask for an explanation of that remark, but I'm too tired." "In a few minutes, everything will be made clear to you."
"Will there be coffee there?" Boothby chuckled.
"Yes, I can guarantee that."
"Good. You won't mind if I use this opportunity to get a few minutes of sleep?" But Vickery had drifted off and didn't hear Boothby's answer. The car jerked to a halt. Vickery, floating in a light sleep, felt his head roll forward, then snap back. He heard the metallic crunch of a door latch giving way, felt a blast of cold air clawing at his face. He came awake suddenly. He looked to his left and seemed surprised to see Boothby sitting there. He glanced at his wristwatch. Good heavens, nearly 8 o'clock. They had been driving the London streets for an hour. His neck ached from the awkward position in which he had slept, slumped down in his seat with his chin pressing against the top of his ribcage. His head throbbed with a craving for caffeine and nicotine. He took hold of the armrest and pushed himself into a sitting position. He looked out the window. East London, Hoxton, an ugly Victorian terrace that looked like a factory fallen on hard times. The terrace on the other side had been bombed. A house here, a pile of rubble there, then a house, then rubble, like a mouth of rotting teeth. He heard Boothby say,
"Wake up, Alfred, we're here." "What on earth were you dreaming about, anyway?"
He felt suddenly self-conscious. What had he dreamt? Had he talked in his sleep? He hadn't dreamt of France since when? Since they cornered Catherine Blake. He wondered if he had dreamt of Helen. Climbing out of the car, he was overcome by a wave of fatigue and had to steady himself by putting a hand on the rear fender of the car. Boothby seemed not to notice, for he was standing on the pavement, glaring back at Vickery impatiently, rattling loose change in his pocket. Rain fell harder now. The bleak landscape somehow made it seem colder. Vickery, joining Boothby on the pavement, breathed deeply of the raw, damp air, and immediately felt better. Boothby led the way through the front door into the hall. The house must have been turned into flats, because there were metal letterboxes on one wall. At the back of the hall, directly opposite the door, was a staircase. Vickery let the door close, and they were enveloped in darkness. He reached out and groped for a light switch. He had seen one there, somewhere. He found it, flipped it. Nothing.
"They take the blackout a little more seriously here than we do up west," Boothby said.
Vickery dug a blackout torch from the pocket of his Macintosh. He handed it to Boothby, and Boothby led the way up the wooden stairs. Vickery could see almost nothing, just the outline of Boothby's broad back, and a puddle of listless light leaking from the weak torch.
Like a blind man, the rest of his senses were suddenly alive. He was treated to a tour of foul odors, urine, stale beer, disinfectant, dried egg frying in old fat. Then the sounds, a parent striking a child, a couple quarreling, another couple noisily copulating. Somewhere he heard notes on an organ and a chorus of male voices. He wondered if there was a church nearby, then realized it was the BBC. Only then did he comprehend that it was Sunday. Kettledrum and the search for Catherine Blake had robbed him of the days of the week. They reached the landing on the top floor. Boothby shone the torch down the hall. The light reflected in the yellow eyes of a skinny cat. It hissed at them in anger before scurrying away. Boothby followed the sound of the church services. The singing had stopped, and the congregation was reciting the Lord's Prayer. Boothby had a key. He stuck it in the lock and switched off the torch before going inside. It was a squalid little room, an unmade bed no larger than Vickery's at MI5 headquarters, a tiny gallery kitchen where coffee burned on a gas ring, a small cafe table where two men sat still as statues, listening to the radio. Both had vile Gauloise cigarettes in their mouths, and the air was blue with smoke. The lights were doused. The only illumination came from narrow windows that looked over the back of a terrace on the next street. Vickery walked to the window and looked out at an alley strewn with rubbish. Two little boys were tossing tin cans into the air and hitting them with sticks. A wind rose, lifting old newspaper into the air like circling gulls. Boothby was dumping the burnt coffee into two suspect enamel mugs. He gave one to Vickery and kept one for himself. The coffee was vile. Bitter, stale, and too strong, but it was hot, and it had caffeine. Boothby used his chipped cup to make the introductions, tipping it first toward the older and larger of the two men.
"Alfred Vickery, this is Pelican. That's not his real name, mind you. That's his code name. You don't get to know his real name, I'm afraid. I'm not sure even I know his real name."
He tipped his mug at the second man, sitting at the table.
"And this fellow is Hawk. That's not a code name, that's his real name. Hawk works for us, don't you, Hawk?"
But Hawk gave no indication he had heard Boothby speak. He was not a hawk, more like a stick, or a rod, or a cane, cadaverous and painfully thin. His cheap wartime suit hung from his bony shoulders as if it had been thrown over a valet. He had the pallor of someone who worked at night and beneath ground. His blonde hair was thinning and going rapidly grey, even though he was no older than the boys Vickery had tutored his last term at the university. He held his Gauloise like a Frenchman, between the tip of his long thumb and forefinger. Vickery had the uncomfortable feeling he had seen him somewhere before, in the canteen maybe, or leaving registry with a batch of files beneath his arm. Or was it leaving Boothby's office by the secret passageway, the way he had seen Grace Clarendon leave that night? Hawk didn't look at Vickery. The only time he moved was when Boothby took a couple of steps toward him. Then he only inclined his head away a fraction of an inch and tightened his face, as if he feared Boothby might strike him. Vickery looked next at Pelican. He might have been a writer, or he might have been a dock worker. He might be German, or he might be French. Polish, perhaps. They were everywhere. Unlike Hawk, Pelican stared straight back at Vickery, holding him in a steady, slightly bemused gaze. Vickery couldn't quite see Pelican's eyes because he wore the thickest glasses Vickery had ever seen, tinted slightly, as if he was sensitive to bright light. Beneath his black leather coat, he wore two sweaters, a grey roll neck and a frayed beige cardigan that looked as though it had been made for him by a well-meaning relative with eyes as good as his. He smoked his Gauloise to a stub, then crushed it out, using the cracked nail of his thick thumb. Boothby removed his coat and turned down the radio. Then he looked at Vickery and said,
"Well now, where should I begin?"
Hawk didn't work for us. Hawk worked for Boothby. Boothby knew Hawk's father, worked with him in India, security. He met young Hawk in Britain in 1935 at a luncheon at the family's Kent estate. Young Hawk was drinking and talking too much, berating his father and Boothby for the kind of work they did, reciting Marx and Lenin like Shakespeare, waving his arms at the splendid gardens
as though they were proof of the corruption of the English ruling classes. After lunch, Hawke Sr. smiled weakly at Boothby to apologize for his son's abominable behavior. Children these days, you know, rot their learning at school. Expensive education gone to waste. Boothby smiled, too. He had been looking for a Hawke for a very long time. Boothby had a new job, keeping an eye on the communists, especially at the universities, Oxford and Cambridge. The Communist Party of Great Britain, with love and encouragement from its Russian masters, was trolling the universities for new members of the flock. The NKVD was looking for spies. Hawke went to work for Boothby at Oxford. Boothby seduced Hawke. Boothby gave direction to his directionless heart. Boothby was good at that. Hawke ran with the communists, drank with them, quarreled with them, played tennis with them, fornicated with them. When the party came for him, Hawke told them to fuck off. Then the Pelican came for him. Hawke called Boothby. Hawke was a good boy. The Pelican was German, Jewish, and a communist. Boothby saw the possibilities immediately. He had been a communist street brawler in Berlin in the 1920s, but with Hitler in power, he thought it best to find safer shores. He emigrated to England in 1933. The NKVD knew about the Pelican from his days in Berlin. When they found out he had settled in England, they recruited him as an agent. He was supposed to be a talent spotter only, no heavy lifting. The first talent he spotted was Boothby's agent, Hawke. At the next meeting between Hawke and the Pelican, Boothby appeared out of nowhere and put the fear of God into him. Pelican agreed to go work for Boothby. "Are you still with me, Alfred?" Vickery, listening at the window, thought, "Oh, yes. In fact, I'm 4 moves ahead of you." In August 1939, Boothby brought Hawke to MI5. On Boothby's orders, the Pelican told his Moscow controllers that his star recruit was now working in British intelligence. Moscow was ecstatic. Pelican's star rose. Boothby used Pelican to funnel true but harmless material back to the Russians, all of it allegedly from his source inside MI5, Hawke. All information the Russians could verify from other sources. Pelican's star soared. In November 1939, Boothby sent the Pelican to the Netherlands. A young, arrogant SS intelligence officer named Walter Schellenberg was making regular trips into Dutch territory under an assumed name to meet with a pair of MI6 agents. Schellenberg was posing as a member of the Schwarze Kapelle and was asking the British for assistance. In truth, he wanted the British to give him the names of real German traitors so he could arrest them. The Pelican met Schellenberg in a cafe in a Dutch town just across the border and offered to work for him as a spy in Britain. He admitted he had done a job or two for the NKVD, including recruiting an Oxford boy named Hawke, who had just joined MI5 and with whom Pelican was still in regular contact. As a sign of goodwill, the Pelican presented Schellenberg with a gift, a collection of Asian erotica. Schellenberg gave Pelican £1,000, a camera, and a radio transmitter, and sent him back to Britain. In 1940, MI5 reorganized. Vernon Kell, the old Director General who founded the department in 1909, was abruptly fired by Churchill. Sir David Petrie took charge. Boothby knew him from India. Boothby was kicked upstairs. He turned over the Pelican to a case officer. "An amateur like you, Alfred. A solicitor, though, not a professor." But he kept a firm hand on him. Pelican was too important to be left to someone who barely knew his way to the canteen. Besides, the Pelican's dealings with Schellenberg were getting damned interesting. Schellenberg was impressed with the Pelican's first reports. The material was all good, but harmless stuff. Munitions production, troop movements, bomb damage assessment. Schellenberg drank greedily of it, even though he knew it was coming from a Jewish communist who had worked as a talent spotter for the NKVD. He and the rest of the SS despised Canaris and the professional intelligence officers at the Abwehr. They mistrusted the information Canaris was giving the Führer. Schellenberg saw his opportunity. He could create a separate network in Britain that reported directly to him and Heinrich Himmler, bypassing the Abwehr altogether. Boothby saw an opportunity, too. He could use the Pelican network for two purposes, to verify misinformation being sent to Canaris through the double-cross system,
and at the same time to sow mistrust between the two rival intelligence organizations. It was a delicate balancing act. MI5 wanted Canaris to remain on the job. After all, his agency had been totally compromised and manipulated. But a little palace intrigue was good, too. British intelligence could blow gently on the flames of dissension and treachery. Boothby started feeding Schellenberg information through the Pelican that raised questions about Canaris's loyalty. Not enough for Schellenberg to plunge the dagger into the old fox's back, mind you, just enough to put the bloody thing in his hand. In 1942, Boothby thought the game had spun out of control. Schellenberg compiled a lengthy list of Canaris's sins and presented it to Himmler. The Double Cross Committee decided to throw Canaris a bone or two to untie the noose around his neck. High-grade intelligence he could show to the Führer to prove the Abwehr's effectiveness. It worked. Himmler stuck Schellenberg's file in the drawer, and the old fox stayed on the job. Boothby was pouring another cup of the obscene coffee. Vickery had been unable to finish his first cup. It sat half-empty in the window next to a dead moth that was slowly turning to powder. The little boys had been chased from the alley by the wind. It gusted, hurling rain against the glass. The room was in darkness. The house had gone quiet after the morning's activities. The only sound was the floor creaking beneath Boothby's restless pacing. Vickery turned from the window and watched him. He looked out of place in the grimy flat, like a priest in a cat house. But he seemed to be enjoying himself thoroughly. Even spies like telling secrets sometimes. Boothby reached inside the breast pocket of his suit, pulled out a single sheet of paper, and handed it to Vickery. It was the memorandum he had written to Boothby weeks ago, asking him to issue a security alert. Vickery looked at the top left corner. It had been stamped Action. Next to the stamp were two nearly illegible initials, BB. Boothby reached out his hand and took the note back from Vickery. Then he gave it to Pelican. Pelican moved for the first time. He laid Vickery's memo on the table and switched on the light. Vickery, standing over him, could see Pelican's eyes crinkle in discomfort behind the dark glasses. From his pocket he removed a German-issue camera, the same one Schellenberg had given him in 1940. He carefully took 10 photographs of the document, like a professional, adjusting the light and the camera angle each time to make certain he had at least one clear negative. Then he raised the camera and pointed it at Hawk. The camera clicked twice, and he put it back in his pocket.
"The Pelican is going to Lisbon tonight," Boothby said. "Schellenberg and friends have requested a meeting with him. We think they're going to give him a very thorough going over. Before they begin their interrogation, Pelican is going to give them this film. The next time Schellenberg and Canaris ride together in the Tiergarten, Schellenberg will tell him about it. Canaris and Fogel will take it as proof that Kettledrum is good as gold. Their agent has not been compromised. British intelligence is in a panic. Therefore, the information she's sending about Operation Mulberry must be accurate. Get the picture, Alfred?"
Vickery and Boothby left first, Boothby leading, Vickery behind him again. Descending the stairs in the dark was harder than climbing them. Twice Vickery had to reach out in the gloom and steady himself on the soft shoulder of Boothby's cashmere coat. The cat reappeared and spat at them from a corner. The foul smells were the same, only the order was reversed. They reached the bottom of the stairs. Vickery felt the soles of his shoes scraping over the soiled linoleum of the hall. Boothby pushed open the door. Vickery, stepping back outside, felt the rain on his face. He was never happier to be out of a place in his life. Walking to the car, he watched Boothby, who was watching him. Vickery felt as though he had just peered through the looking-glass. He had been given a guided tour of a secret world of deception he never imagined existed. Vickery climbed into the car. Boothby got in next to him and closed the door. They were driven to Kingsland Road, then south toward the river. Vickery glanced at Boothby once, then averted his eyes. Boothby looked pleased with himself. Vickery said,
"You didn't have to show me all that. Why did you?" "Because I wanted to."
"What happened to need to know?"
"I had no need to know all that. You could have funneled my memo to Schellenberg and never told me about any of it."
"That's true."
"So why did you do it? To impress me?"
"In a way, yes," Boothby said.
You've impressed a great many people with your idea to leave Catherine Blake in place, including me. I realized I've underestimated you, Alfred. Your intelligence and your ruthlessness. It takes a cold-hearted bastard to send Peter Jordan back into that bedroom with a briefcase full of double-cross. I wanted to show you the next level of the game.
Is that how you think of this, Sir Basil? A game?
Not just a game, Alfred. The game.
Boothby smiled. It could be his greatest weapon. Vickery, gazing at his face, imagined it was the same smile he used on his wife, Penelope, when assuring her he had given up his latest little love. The illusion of Kettledrum required Vickery to spend much of his day in his cramped office in St. James's Street. After all, they were trying to convince the Abwehr and the rest of the department that Vickery was still pursuing a German agent with access to top-secret material. He closed the door and sat down at his desk. He desperately needed sleep. He laid his head on the desk like a drowsy student and closed his eyes. When he did, he was immediately back in the grimy Hoxton flat. He saw the pelican, and he saw the hawk. He saw the little boys in the filthy alleyway, pale, malnourished legs poking from their shorts. He saw the moth turning to dust. He heard the organ music echoing through the grand cathedral. He thought of Matilda. Guilt over missing her funeral flashed over him like hot water poured down his neck. Damn, why can't I turn it off just for a few minutes and sleep? Then he saw Boothby, striding around the flat, telling the story of the hawk and the pelican and the elaborate deception he had foisted on Walter Schellenberg. He realized he had never seen Boothby happier. Boothby in the field, surrounded by his agents. Boothby drinking vile coffee from a chipped enamel mug. He realized he had misjudged Boothby, or, more accurately, he had been misled by Boothby. The entire department had been. Boothby was a lie, the comic bureaucrat preening around his grand office, the silly personal maxims, the red light and the green light, the ridiculous fetish about moisture rings on his precious furniture. It was all a lie. That was not Basil Boothby. Basil Boothby was not a pusher of paper. Basil Boothby was a runner of agents. A liar, a manipulator, a deceiver. Vickery, drifting off to sleep, found he loathed Boothby just a little less. But one thing troubled him. Why had Boothby lowered the veil? And why now? Vickery felt himself descending into a dreamless sleep. In the distance, Big Ben tolled 10 o'clock. The chimes faded, only to be replaced by the muffled clatter of the teleprinters outside his closed door. He wanted to sleep for a long time. He wanted to forget about it all, just for a few minutes. But after a short while, the shaking began. Gentle at first, then violent. Then the sound of a girl's voice, at first downy and pleasant, then slightly alarmed.
"Professor Vickery! Professor Vickery! Please wake up! Professor Vickery! Can you hear me?"
Vickery, his head still resting on his folded hands, opened his eyes. For an instant he thought it was Helen, but it was only Prudence, a flaxen angel from the typing pool.
"I'm so sorry to wake you, Professor, but Harry Dalton's on the line, and he says it's urgent. Let me bring you a cup of hot tea, you poor lamb."